From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. And this hour of Connections, we are talking about something that, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, affects 27.6 million American adults. It's heart disease. February is American Heart Month, and we have a couple of doctors in studio to take your questions about really anything heart-related. You had a question about yourself. You have a question about a family member. We're going to be talking surgery, different procedures, prevention, all kinds of different things. This is a great opportunity for you to have questions answered on anything heart-related. Here with us, we have Dr. Rebecca Schalick, who is a cardiologist who recently joined the University of Rochester Cardiology Department at Highland Hospital. She's also a senior instructor of clinical medicine in cardiology in the School of Medicine and Dentistry, and she is mildly perturbed that her title isn't even longer.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Dr. Schalick, thank you. We all have long titles. Thank you very much. Yes. Both of you very generous with your time this afternoon. She's alongside Dr. John Bisignano, who's a professor of medicine and a director of outpatient services in the Division of Cardiology and director of the Comprehensive Hypertension Center at the University of Rochester. Dr. Bisignano, welcome to you as well.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, this hour is being produced in association with the national public television show, Second Opinion, which is produced by WXXI Public Broadcasting and the University of Rochester Medical Center. And today's broadcast is part of the Second Opinion Live series. You can participate in today's conversation. Call us with any questions you have on heart health, disease, anything you need to know. 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255. You can tweet your questions to the hashtag 2NDOP. Special thanks to the sponsor of Second Opinion, the Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, and thank you to our public radio and television supporters who help us make shows like this possible. All right, let's get started. And I just kind of want to speak generally here. When we talk heart disease, we always hear it is the number one killer in the United States. I assume that is still the case, yes?
That is the case. I think one of the big things about February is that's what we're trying to get out there is February is Heart History Month and Heart Disease Month because it is the number one killer of men and women to this day.
And forgive my ignorance here. I always assume smoking rates are on the decline in this country. I hope they are. And does a decline in smoking rate correspond to any decline in heart problems in this country that we know of?
Well, smoking rates have been declining over the years,
okay.
And they're beginning to level off a little bit, and we're a little concerned that we should be pushing smoking rates down a little bit more. But there's still plenty of other reasons for heart disease, like diabetes, the overweight epidemic, mm-hmm. High blood pressure rates are going up. And so there's plenty that we could do to prevent heart disease and also plenty that we can do once somebody has heart disease.
Before we get to the phones, and the phones are already ringing, which is great, when we talk heart disease, it's a big umbrella, but we're generally speaking about, you know, what there's a lot that falls under that range. Doctor, what would you say falls into that umbrella?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a broad definition, and depending on who you're talking to, it can be anything from heart attack and, you know, heart symptoms to, in general, having congenital heart disease. So I think it's a very broadly used term, often misunderstood. But when I think of heart disease, I think of the kind of classic heart blockages, heart attack, though you could throw congestive heart failure into that valvular disease as well. So it's really a very broadly used term.
And listeners, I'm going to start with your phone calls now. If we don't get more of your calls, I'm going to ask all of my questions this hour about me and my family, which is great because I have a captive audience of two great doctors here. But this is a great chance for you to do that. And we're going to start in Ithaca. This is Robin on the phone with the first question. Go ahead, Robin.
Hi. I'm wondering if you're a healthy woman in her 60s with no known heart issues. Are there checks that you should be getting in your 60s or as you look into the 70s? Thank you very much.
Thanks, Robin.
Hi, Robin. Yes, absolutely. I think the big thing that if I could give a takeaway message would be know your numbers. Even if you're in your 50s, 60s, 70s, that's the kind of first place to start. You know, we know a lot about everybody else, but I think it's important to know things like what your blood pressure is your cholesterol doing. Certainly, you know, we all know our weight. That's an easy one. But I think the blood pressure and cholesterol tend to be often overlooked. Maybe you talk to your doctor once a year when you see them, but that's a good place to start. So certainly that would be an annual check you could do.
Okay.
Sure. And it's always a plus to, you know, watch what you eat, keep your exercise level up to about 20 to 30 minutes every day, hopefully five times per week. And all this can help in the long run to push off heart disease.
Joel writes to the program and wants to know, has there been any broad-scale shift in thinking toward the vegan diet among cardiologists for their patients? I sense a change in thinking among doctors, but I don't know if it's a local, national, or global shift.
So I've certainly heard a lot about the vegan diet, and I think there are a lot of really good messages from the vegan diet. Now, what you want to take away from it, whether it's, you know, the ethical concerns, the economical concerns, or the health concerns, I think anybody who's eating more fruits and vegetables is absolutely doing, you know, the best that you can. Now, whether or not it's pure vegan, I think there's a lot of topic for debate. But certainly, my advice is always, you know, you want to eat as many fruits and vegetables as possible, which I think is a big part of the vegan diet. I don't know, Dr. B, if you feel any differently.
Yeah, I agree. I think every step someone could take toward a vegan diet is probably a plus. And it's just, I think for many of our listeners, it would be difficult to follow a pure vegan diet. But if you can decrease your intake of meats, animal fats, it's certainly a plus. And moving even one or two steps in that direction is a good thing.
Dr. B,
yes.
The rest of the hour, I know what's going to happen now. We've got vegans who are going to call this program and say, you can't say it's difficult. We do it. It can be done. You know, I think what you're trying to say is for some people who feel like it's a big lift, it may seem unrealistic, but you can move in that direction. It doesn't have to be sort of cold turkey. It can be incremental.
Oh, by all means, if someone can achieve a full vegan diet, I think it's all positive. And I think there's a lot of groups in town and in the region who can really provide the support and the information needed. And it's something we're all for. And we know it has a great benefit. It's one of the only approaches that's actually been shown to reverse coronary disease.
I think
that's very important.
Reverse, that's an amazing statement, too.
But the big question is how many people can be on it? And if somebody could take a few steps in that direction, and that's all they could do, I think that's certainly great.
All right, listeners, again, it's 844-295-TALK. We're talking about your heart health and any questions you have, 844-295-8255. I was born with Wolff-Parkinson-White syndrome. I had a catheter ablation at the age of 17. I've got a son about to turn 5. Should I get him checked for it?
Wow, so that's a good question, Evan. I didn't know that.
Yes.
So there is a family component of Wolff-Parkinson-White, and I would probably at least get him an EKG just to see. Now you should be talking to your doctor about this too.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say, you know, there's a lot of congenital things out there. There's certainly a genetic component to a lot of heart disease, including Wolff-Parkinson-White, which is an electrical disease. So I think there's still a lot to find out about it. But if you have family members who have heart disease, whether it's electrical, heart blockages, or heart attacks, you know, knowing your family history is a big part of that. So definitely talk to your doctor, talk to your son's doctor, and I think that's the first place to start.
Okay. Dr. B, agree?
I agree. Yeah, absolutely. I think having your son looked at by somebody is very important to do.
Yeah, when I was getting the catheter ablation for it was still new-ish at the time. You know, it wasn't open heart, no scars, and it went really great. I mean, it's amazing. I look back and I just think, you know, I can run, I work out, it's no problem. I'm just amazed what the medical community can do. What I don't know is if we're seeing more diagnosis of it. Are we more aware of it? Have the rates changed of Wolff-Parkinson-White?
If I had to guess, I'd say the rates haven't changed. I think our diagnostic tools have gotten better,
mm-hmm.
and we are more aware of what to look for. I think there's still a lot to learn about it, but I think a lot of it is more we've been better at diagnosing it. I think the rates are probably similar, but I couldn't back that up.
And I played, you know, sports in high school growing up, and I used to get tachycardia and think that's normal. That's what happens when your body is cranked up and you're running, you're doing this. And it took, you know, a kind of little scary little incident where I learned that this is not what's supposed to be happening. So, Dr. B, any message for athletes and parents of athletes there who, you know, every year you hear sad stories about people who did not know about a heart condition, not just WPW, of course. But what's the message for parents and athletes?
Well, I think that there's a number of similar conditions to WPW. And I think teenagers and parents should be aware, just sort of maintain an awareness of anything that seems unusual to them, you know, an unusual lightheadedness or chest pain or a feeling that the heart is really beating out of the chest to an unusual degree, and bring that to the doctor's attention quickly.
All right, let me get back to the phones. Patricia in Aranda, quite next up. Go ahead, Patricia.
Yes, Evan, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm one of those vegans that you mentioned a few minutes ago you may be hearing from to talk about the difficulties or not of living and using a plant-based diet. And a year ago, my husband and I saw Dr. Michael Greger speak at Rochester Academy of Medicine. He's a vegan, and he's talking about the benefits of a plant-based diet. And my husband and I were both convinced, based on the data, that a whole foods plant-based diet can reduce, in some cases even eliminate, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes. And so last March, we started and we eliminated all the dairy, all the animal products from our diet. And
cold turkey, you just took it all out?
I'm sorry?
You kind of went from 0 to 60? You didn't do it incrementally?
We went from 0 to 60. Wow. My husband has, the triad, the hypertension, high cholesterol, diabetes. And so his blood pressure has come way down, his cholesterol, he's off of his cholesterol meds. It does take more time to, and a little bit more creative to make meals that are satisfying, but neither one of us have feel that we're missing out on anything, that we're not satisfied. So I would just like to, for your audience, to let them know that there are resources available in Rochester that can help people who are interested. The Rochester Vegan Society is open to the public and is a great resource for people who want to learn more about eating a whole foods plant-based diet. And I do say, and we're just regular middle-aged people. We did it. Grew up on meat and potatoes and haven't looked back.
All right, one more question.
And needless to say, we both lost 25 pounds.
I was going to ask you.
I've never been able to lose. I rode my bicycle 3,000 miles across the country, and I only lost 3 pounds.
Yeah, I was going to ask you.
I've lost 25 pounds.
1 year in, is that the biggest change? I mean, is it weight loss? Is it how you feel? What the biggest change? It sounds like the weight loss.
It's how I feel, weight loss. And also, I'm more and more conscious of the ethical issues related to mass food production and animal cruelty. That was not my motivation when I started, but as I've learned more, I realize that's also another benefit.
Thank you, Patricia. Thanks for the phone call. I think, as Dr. B said, not everybody can go from 0 to 60 like that, but pretty remarkable. Big change.
It's great when they do, and it's great that she's going to be reaping the benefits, which are sure to come.
All right, an email question from a listener named Phil, similar to what we heard, but we're getting questions from people who are just, again, saying, what should I be doing? So Phil says, healthy man, in the age range of 60 to 75, with no history or familiar history of heart disease, how often would an EKG or an echo be appropriate?
So I think, certainly going to see your doctor once a year is absolutely the minimum. If for no other reason than they will check your blood pressure, they'll check your weight, make sure that everything is, pretty much the same year to year. That's what I look for. An EKG once a year, I think, is reasonable. Things that would make me change my mind about that would really be based on your symptoms. If you're noticing differences in how you exercise, you can't, do the same amount of workout you used to be able to, or you can't climb stairs like you used to. If something changes, that I'd say is even more of an indicator that you need to get in and see somebody right away. But if you're healthy, feeling well, I'd say a once a year visit with an EKG is reasonable, as long as your numbers are kind of in the good range that I'm sure your doctor's checking.
Okay. Dr. B, happy with that?
Right. I wouldn't do any more than that. For someone who's feeling well, who has the ability to exercise, no chest pain, no shortness of breath, and an annual visit where the blood pressure is looked at. And the blood pressure goal right now is a little bit unclear, but if your blood pressure is greater than 120 over 80, it's something that really has to be watched. And as that goes up, certainly when it's over 140 over 90, is something that probably warrants some sort of treatment.
Okay. Keith and Henrietta on the phone. Next up, go ahead, Keith.
Evan, I'm in Farmington, but thanks. I got a couple. I just want to put a plug in, and I think the doctors would agree. I would encourage everybody to learn CPR. You may never need it, but at least if you know it and you witness somebody going down and they don't have a pulse, doing anything is better than doing nothing. And on the other two questions I'd like to add. I heard a statistic that most heart attacks are between the ages of 60 and 70, and the people that witness the heart attack is always the wife, or most often is the wife. Is that true?
Well, I think that's pretty variable. I think just a matter of timing of a patient's spouse is probably the most common person who's near someone when they have a heart attack.
Sure.
As one goes over 60 years of age, the incidence of heart attacks certainly goes up, so that may be what you're seeing. But I'd also like to echo your comments about CPR. The present guidelines recommend just hands-only CPR, so there's no necessity to consider mouth-to-mouth resuscitation. And this is particularly important in areas like Rochester, Monroe County, where usually an ambulance can get to where they need to be within 6 or 7 minutes. And just be doing hands-only CPR during that time can really be life-saving.
Okay. Keith, you had anything else you want to follow with there?
Nope, that was it.
All right, thanks for the phone call. And yeah, I mean, I think once in a while a company will offer CPR training for employees and those kind of things. And just, it's always good to be on the lookout for that kind of an opportunity. We hear stories every year of people doing remarkable things and just saying, I had no idea that my training was going to pay off. So Herman in Brighton next up on the phone. Go ahead, Herman.
Hi. My doctor put me on statins, even though my cholesterol was not outside of the normal range. She told me that nowadays there's some formula that they use to calculate the risk of a cardiovascular event, and that without the statins, my risk was something like 10%, and with it, it would be lowered, I don't know, maybe to 7%, I can't remember. So, I know there are some risks to taking statins, and in fact, it has. I've been on it for less than a year, and it's already driven my blood sugar up to the border of being pre-diabetic. So, you know, how do I evaluate whether it makes sense to continue using the statins? And would there, if I wanted to not use the statins, would there be something else that I could do instead that wouldn't carry the same risks?
So to address the first part of your question, you're absolutely right. It's a kind of moving target with the numbers. And certainly in the last couple of years, we've moved away from purely basing whether or not somebody should be on statin and cholesterol medicine purely based on the cholesterol numbers. Now, that is a shift, and I think it's taking time in both the physician community and the community in general to kind of come to terms with that. But now we look at really a person's overall risk factors, whether it's hypertension, diabetes, whether you're on blood pressure medicines, those sorts of things. And a big component of that is just your age alone. So unfortunately, we are not getting younger. And the older we get, the higher the risk of heart disease. So that drives that risk way up. So a lot of people who didn't used to need statin therapy now do qualify based on this risk calculator. Now, we don't look at the numbers as much, but they do still play a role. So, you know, in every person's case, what I always look at are the risks and benefits of continuing statin therapy. And if you are having difficulties with the medicine, there's a lot of different things you can try, whether it's trying a different statin medication, continuing to work on your other risk factors and get those a little bit better controlled. Or, you know, even things like weight loss that can bring your blood pressure down, for example, and that changes your risk calculator. There's a lot of different things you can do, but we have moved away from purely number-based cholesterol treatment.
Okay, well, I'm not overweight at all, and my blood pressure is normal, so it was only based on that calculator that, you know, and of course my age is, I'm sure definitely
that's,
played that's a role.
That's the one we can't control, right,
but,
right.
Of course, if my blood sugar is higher and if I'm becoming pre-diabetic, then that's a risk too. So does it make sense to continue on statins? Is there something else I can do?
You know, that's a great question. I think, I mean, I can't make you younger, so that part's done. The other things that you could try, though, would be considering alternative statin therapies. There's a lot of different medications out there, and even though one might not be for you, there might be another one that works for you. Certainly that blood sugar effect does occur, but I think sometimes that's a precursor to actually being pre-diabetic, not related to the statin medication. So it might not just be the statin that's doing it.
And Dr. B?
So in the clinical trials that looked at statins, they dropped cardiovascular risk by almost 50%. So that if you start off at 20%, it'll drop you to about 10%. If you start at 10%, it drops to about 5%. And they acknowledged in these clinical trials that it raised blood sugar a little bit, pushing some people into the pre-diabetic stage and also even pushing some people into the diabetic range. But even with that, they still dropped cardiovascular risk by nearly 50%. And I think that's important to note, that even if it's pushing the blood sugar up, you're still enjoying the really quite significant drop in cardiovascular risk.
On Twitter, Benjamin writes to the program, I'm 47 years old, good health, I have an enlarged heart. Are there long-term concerns and any ways to minimize problems?
I think anytime you have an enlarged heart, there are absolutely concerns. I don't know the details of why, but normally one of the things I'd look for is why do you have an enlarged heart? And that's kind of the first step, is if you determine why, then you try to treat the reason why. And there can be a myriad of reasons. So once you kind of address that, then you sort of look at down the road what your risks are. But absolutely, anytime you have an enlarged heart, you want to look into that and kind of tackle the issues.
Okay. Would you stay in more regular touch with physicians?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely. You need regular follow-up, certainly just to make sure you're feeling well. But also, again, I don't know the background behind the story, but you might need additional medications or more routine follow-up.
Okay. On the phone, Eric in Rochester is next. Go ahead, Eric.
Hello, I'm 24 years old. I'm following a viral infection. I developed constrictive pericarditis, and I was just curious to complications or anything congestive heart failure that may or may not occur. And I've been advised by my mother, who's an emergency room nurse for a very long time, to get my pericardium removed if it's the most viable option. And I was curious as to whether or not there was any information that you two could offer.
All right, Eric, stay there. Doctors, what do you think?
Well, I think that viruses can infect the heart and infect the surface of the heart, the pericardium, like you mentioned, to various degrees in many people. And some people do get an irritation of the surroundings of the heart, the pericardium, like you have, which can cause some stiffening of that area. I think a lot of the decision as to what to do at this point is based on how you feel. And it's something that probably should be monitored closely with perhaps frequent ultrasounds, echocardiograms, to make sure that there's been no change in it. Whether you actually need the pericardium removed or not is a difficult judgment to make sitting here, but something that you should probably be followed closely by a cardiologist to follow you along.
Eric, does that help?
My cardiologist has said almost precisely what you said, based on how you feel. When I'm exerting myself quite heavily in soccer and such, I do experience trepidation to get off the field because I'm extremely winded and my heart's really going. And I'm not sure whether or not I was hospitalized for 10 to 9 weeks, give or take, and it was almost complete atrophy of my body. So I'm not sure if that's just me having to get my butt in shape again, or whether or not that my pericardium is restricting me so much to the point that, it's dangerous. And also, would you recommend a stress test or anything like that?
Well, that may be something that your cardiologist may want to do, but it really is a difficult judgment, and there's a lot of additional testing that your cardiologist may need to do in the future. But it's largely based on a judgment of whether these symptoms are attributable to your pericardium.
Good luck, Eric. And obviously, it sounds like you're in touch with your cardiologist. I mean, I think that's the big key here. Is one of the hard things to do is we can get really good general ideas. Sometimes individual patients' cases, it's tough to do over the phone, but we're doing our best with the general ideas. And Eric, I hope you stay in touch with your doctor and you're feeling great soon. Carlene in Rochester is on the phone. She's next. Go ahead, Carlene.
Yes. I've been treated for high blood pressure for years. But one, I just discovered something in the protocol in the doctor's office that is making my numbers crazy. When you come into your doctor's office, internist or regular doctor, any doctor, you're taken in by the nurse, they weigh you, they take a little history, and they take your blood pressure. My blood pressure, I said to the girl, if I take it at home, you're supposed to be sitting for 20 minutes, absolutely still, feet on the floor, etc. And I said, I'd really rather you took my pressure at the end of the visit rather than at the beginning. She took my pressure, and it was 181 over, 80. I complained to the doctor about it, etc. He took my blood pressure at the end of the visit. It was 131. Over 70. Now that's a drop of 50 points. So here the doctor is seeing these numbers, and it's everybody who comes into the office. This is the protocol. It happens to be through Strong Health, but it could just as easily be one of the other, Unity or whomever. And I would think it's very valuable. I wonder how many people are being overprescribed medication for their blood pressure. So often a doctor wants to add a second or third medication, and you don't need it. So then you go home, and in the middle of the night, you can't. You're feeling dizzy. You're feeling just not yourself. Do the doctors know what the protocol is in doctors' offices?
All right. So thank you, Carlene. Let's let our doctors respond to that. Go ahead.
Well, I think that that's really a very important question, because wherever you go, you get your blood pressure taken, whether it's a dermatologist's office, an eye doctor's office, or your general medicine doctor's office. And having a good piece of data on which to make judgments regarding blood pressure treatment is incredibly important. And, you know, for some people, they can walk through a waiting room, have their blood pressure taken, and it's pretty much what you would find when they have at home. But a properly taken blood pressure requires sitting quietly in a room with both feet flat on the ground and having the blood pressure taken at that point. And that was the approach that was used in the clinical trials, where we got our blood pressure goals of 140 over 90 or 120 over 80. And you're absolutely right that the blood pressure has to be taken properly. And you make a very good point. And I think that in every office in the country, patients are sometimes brought in a little too fast, blood pressure taken a little too quickly, and you're very right in asking for your blood pressure to be taken again after 5 minutes of rest with both feet on the ground.
Dr. Bisignano is president of the American Society for Hypertension, right?
That's right.
And so when it comes to blood pressure here, how directly, this is such an ignorant question, and forgive me, but I'm curious, how directly related is high blood pressure to, impending conditions or issues, catastrophic heart failures, that kind of a thing here? I mean, how much can you draw a line from people with high blood pressure to big problems?
Well, the way of looking at high blood pressure, it's probably the single most modifiable long-term risk factor for heart disease. So it's something that we need to treat for years in order to prevent heart disease, but it's the single most important thing to look at, the single most important thing to treat. Short-term elevations in blood pressure, like if your blood pressure happens to be 160 today because you're taking a cold medication or something, is probably less important. But what we look at is the long-term elevations. And even small elevations, being consistently in the 150s or the 160s, can significantly increase heart disease risk. For every 20 points the blood pressure goes up, it doubles the risk of heart disease.
Tell me that again, that last statistic.
Okay, so for every 20 points the blood pressure goes up, your risk of heart disease doubles. So that if your blood pressure is 40 millimeters of mercury above the goal, you can decrease your risk by half twice, so decrease your risk by 75% by getting treatment.
On that subject, after we get our only break of the hour, Brenda and Byron's got a question about whether blood pressure can be too low. We're going to talk about that. Eric has a question. We've got some questions about food and products, coffee, nuts, things like that. So we'll work all of that in. Let's get our only break of the hour and continue with this edition of Second Opinion Live on Connections with Dr. John Bisignano, who's professor of medicine and director of outpatient services in the Division of Cardiology and director of the Comprehensive Hypertension Center at the University of Rochester, and Dr. Rebecca Shalek, a cardiologist who joined the University of Rochester Cardiology Department recently at Highland Hospital, and she's also a senior instructor of clinical medicine in cardiology in the School of Medicine and Dentistry. Let's get that break and right back to your phone calls next. I'm Evan Dawson. Monday on The Next Connections, a conversation about a great small business success story in Rochester. Norman Brown grew up in the 19th Ward, graduated, then went away, worked in business and various places for years, but came back in recent years to create a little restaurant, the Arnett Cafe. Have you had their chicken and waffles? Their great story, Monday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and let's stay on the blood pressure theme. Brenda in Byron has a question. Go ahead, Brenda.
Hi, Evan. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My husband has had heart issues of various kinds, electrical problems, a defective valve, mitral valve prolapse. He's had a heart attack. He had a lot of stuff going on. And we went on a more veggie-centric, not vegan, but, half the plate is veggies. We do meatless Monday, all that good stuff. And he got much better in every category, including doesn't need to be on a gout maintenance drug anymore. I'm on the same diet, and I was normal and healthy. And my question is, my blood pressure is super low now. It's like 90 over 58. is there any danger in having too low of a blood pressure?
Right, Brenda.
Thank you, Brenda.
So, yes, blood pressure that's too low can also be a problem. The first question I always ask people when they tell me their blood pressure is low is, how are you feeling? Because that's really the bottom line is, if your numbers look low, and I'm talking like your numbers like 90s over 50s, but you feel well, then chances are your body's kind of acclimated to that blood pressure. So you're probably okay. I wouldn't start taking anything to raise the blood pressure. I wouldn't tell you to go back to your other diet. But if you're feeling lightheaded, dizzy, certainly if you ever pass out, things like that, that starts to tell me that maybe your blood pressure is a little bit too low. So if you were taking blood pressure medicines at that point, you know, we might need to reevaluate if you need to cut back on something.
Okay. Here's an email on a little bit more on the blood pressure question from Tim in Pittsford. He says, I'm 38 years old. I'm an avid runner. My weekly running mileages average between 60 to 120 miles a week, depending on the time of the season. I eat plenty of fruits and vegetables, but I also eat meat 3 times a week. Other than venison, which is very low fat, I eat some very high fat meats. I'm 5'11". I'm between 148 and 158 pounds. Again, depending on the amount of running I'm doing. My blood pressure is normally 95 to 98 over 60. My question would be, can I get away with eating high fat meat without having to worry too much about heart attack as long as I keep running? One of the perks of running so much just happens to be I can pretty much eat anything without gaining weight, so I'm hoping the answer is yes.
Well, that's a hard question to answer because I mean you're doing so many of the right things, you know, that amount of running, you know, eating very well, you have a great weight, and you know the question is can you add a little risk to what you're presently doing, and will that make a difference? And it's a hard question to answer because you're asking whether it's okay to take a little extra risk here. And it in the scope of things for someone like you who's doing everything else pretty close to optimally, the risk is probably pretty low, if not negligible, in someone who's 38 years old and in such great physical shape. But I don't think that I want to come out here and recommend that you eat a diet higher in animal fats and move things in that direction. I think you're probably best off where you are right now.
And the other thing that I was going to add is that I didn't hear about is really family history. And genetics does, unfortunately, play a large role in this, for good or bad. And some people have good genes and some people don't. And you can do all the right things, and I still see things happen. So anything you can do to optimize it, I think you want to do. And genes, we can't do anything about that.
Tim, thanks. And yeah, I hope your genes are pretty clean in that way. It is amazing when you hear people who have heart attack and you go, oh my gosh, that person is in such great shape. And then sometimes you see people live to 90 or so and they've smoked and they've done these things. Genetics is an amazing thing and you can do your best to circumvent it. And that's kind of what we're talking about here. You know, what can we really do to optimize our health regardless of our genes? Sean in Rochester has a question about what we consume. Most of us drink coffee. Go ahead, Sean.
I'm just wondering if you guys have an answer to that question. Is coffee good? Is it bad? If I search online, it depends on what site you're looking at that say, you know, coffee is just fine for your heart or coffee is going to kill you. I'm kind of a high energy person, so I've got to have my coffee, and I'm thinking about going to Starbucks right now and getting another cup. And otherwise, I'm in, you know, good health. You know, I'm in my weight range and I exercise half an hour a day, and, you know, I would just love to know the answer.
Thanks, Sean.
Okay, so the studies that were done on coffee, particularly coffee and high blood pressure, were done in the late 1970s and early 1980s, where a cup of coffee was an 8-ounce cup of something like Maxwell House coffee or Chase and Sanborn coffee, for those of you on the air who could remember that. And the caffeine. Sanka has no caffeine. So that's,
oh, really? Okay.
So, yeah, that's, well, okay. You know. So the caffeine levels at that point were much lower than we see now, but the studies at that point showed that there might be a little elevation in blood pressure for up to 30 minutes, but that it would fade and not really cause long-term sustained elevation in blood pressure. Now a cup of coffee is often 16 or 20 or 24 ounces of a type of coffee that has twice to three times as much caffeine. And there hasn't been any real studies done in a systematic way on that.
Coffee is like the biggest product sold in this country. They're not studying this? How are they? Somebody should study this.
Somebody should study this.
Yes.
Because we're still relying on the 1980s.
I've got data. Nothing to do. I'm on it.
Okay. Well, maybe
you're
we, should,
it, Evan.
We should do this.
So the bottom line is, if you look at studies, they're probably a little outdated given our norms and our habits.
Right. And if you're finding your blood pressure is high and you're drinking 48 ounces of bold coffee a day, there may be a link to that in you.
Okay.
I think the other thing, I mean, coffee and wine are the million-dollar questions. You know, how much is too much? How much is too little? I think moderation is still key, and unfortunately, we don't have the textbook answer. But I think, you know, I've certainly had patients who had to stop coffee because they get palpitations, and then some patients can drink, you know, 10 cups a day, no trouble, and seem to be doing okay. So,
good luck to you, Sean. Back to the phones we go. Mike in Brighton. Go ahead, Mike.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I am 41 years old. My numbers are always good. Blood pressure, cholesterol, everything normal. I, you know, go to regular checkups. You know, I definitely could stand to lose a couple of pounds, but overall I live an active lifestyle. I feel good, have a good diet. And my father actually passed away at the age of 59 of a heart attack quite suddenly. And unfortunately for my family history, he was an avid avoider of doctor's appointments. So nobody really knows why. You know, he had no obvious risk factors, but then again, he wasn't under regular doctor's care, so we don't know a lot about it. My wife has always wanted me to get a stress test or do some kind of further testing for my heart. My last GP and the one I have now both say that with all the other factors in the, you know, in the state that they're in, that my father's family history alone is not enough to require anything further. And I just wanted to see what the, you know, what the doctors today thought of that.
All right, Mike, thank you. Doctors?
I think I kind of agree with what your doctors have said, unless I'm really pressed, meaning I think you have some serious risk factors for sure with your family history. But like you said, without knowing exactly what was going on with your dad, it's hard to say. But unless you're having symptoms of chest pain, shortness of breath, difficulty exercising, you know, the kind of heart problems that we think about, changes in your exercise capacity, I don't know that a stress test will do a lot in terms of predicting heart attacks. You know, people can still have heart attacks even if you have a healthy stress test at age 41. So it certainly sometimes gives peace of mind, but I don't know that it will prevent you from having a heart attack down the road. It sounds like you're already doing all those things anyways.
And monitoring the standard risk factors, high blood pressure, the cholesterol panel, is really the best way to push off heart disease. You know, routine stress testing in people without symptoms is something that we used to do a bit of a decade or two ago, but we've learned that in the vast majority of people is really not necessary.
Hmm. Good luck to you, Mike. Thanks for the phone call. Pat emails the program to ask, are there recommendations regarding calcium supplementation, as that may relate to calcium deposits, which could compromise one's cardiac health?
Well, that's a tough question. We've been going back and forth on that for, you know, probably the past 5 or 10 years. There was some concern that higher calcium levels could be associated with some earlier heart disease, you know, but other studies have not supported that quite as vigorously. So it's something we're keeping an eye on right now.
Needs more study
for sure.
Okay, it's a great question, Pat, and hopefully we'll get more study on that. We'll go back to the phones in Rochester. Marianne next. Go ahead, Marianne.
Hi, my question might be related to migraine and heart. I'm in my mid-60s. I am in good health. All my blood tests are normal. I exercise regularly, walk like 4 or 5 times a week, do yoga. I do tend to run a kind of high average heart rate of like 90, but my doctor never seems concerned about it. And I do have chronic migraine. I'm a poster child for chronic migraine, and I get Botox injections, stuff like that. And last week, I suddenly developed a low heart rate for about 3 days of 60 per minute, and I had sort of an irregular heart rate. And each day I had it, I would wake up in the morning with a migraine. I went to my primary care. He did an EKG. He said it was normal. This was after it was all over. And he said, basically, there's really nothing you can do about it. Just if it happens again, he might send me to a cardiologist and have him, I would wear a monitor. And I just wanted to know what your feeling was about a story like mine.
Well, stay there, Marianne. I don't know if they have any follow-up questions for you, but...
Okay.
Doctor, go ahead.
Hi, Marianne. Yeah, so, well, I'm sorry to hear about that. I think migraines are tough. And is, in terms of what was going on that day, it's always difficult to kind of play Monday morning quarterback and figure out exactly what happened those couple of days.
Yeah.
Certainly, you know, it sounds like you're checking your heart rate regularly, which is good. Anytime, you know, someone talks to me about an irregular heart rate, that is usually something that I pay attention to. So I think, you know, wearing a monitor is reasonable if it does happen, because we can see things and it does sound like a change for you. So that's what I'm always listening for. Is this a change? And to you, it sounds like it was.
Mm-hmm. So, but my PCP said, you know, your EKG was absolutely perfect. I had it on Monday. It was perfect. So at this point, I would be inclined to wait and see if it happens again.
Mm-hmm.
And then call me and I'll send you a cardiologist. We'll put you on a monitor at that point. So your inclination would be to do it now?
Well, everybody's a little bit different. An EKG is a great test, but it's really just a snapshot in time, whereas the monitor uh-huh. is worn for a longer period of time with the hopes of catching something that the EKG missed. So I think it depends on, you know, how strongly you feel about it and how strongly your doctor feels that this was, you know, a really irregular heartbeat for you, and it's something that we certainly wouldn't want to miss. So it might not be a bad idea to talk about wearing a monitor.
Okay, and so you don't see this as something related to, like, some kind of freaky or unusual migraine?
Again, it's hard to look back and say. Migraines do a lot of weird things. I've heard a lot of different weird migraine stories over the past few years, so it uh-huh. could theoretically be related. The other thing I know, and I don't know in your case, but sometimes migraine medicines that are used do slow the heart rate down, so that is a possibility sometimes, but medications for migraines can affect heart rate, too.
Okay, great. All right, well, I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck, Marianne. I mean, migraines are such a complex problem. I can attest to that. And that's another one where you go, someday they're going to wake up and they're going to find something preventative that doesn't have side effects. Mm-hmm. But who knows when that day is coming. Good luck, Marianne. Al in Rochester on the phone next. Go ahead, Al.
Hi, Evan. Thanks a lot. I'm a local physician. I tend to follow a Mediterranean diet myself with limited meat. But there are some recent reports that suggest that actually a high-fat, low-carb diet is better than a low-fat, high-carb diet. And so not pushing for high-saturated fats or meat, but I just want to bring the carbohydrates into the discussion and see what the doctors think about that.
Okay. Doctors? Dr. Bisignano?
Well, I think there's always been controversy on what the best diet is. And, you know, in my opinion, if the only goal is to prevent heart disease, then a purely plant-based diet is probably the optimal diet. Now, as I mentioned a little bit earlier on, the problem with it is that not everybody can achieve success with that. And if you go to the diet bookstore of the section of our local bookstores, it's huge. And the reason is because every diet has somebody who may benefit from it. So there are people who may achieve weight loss on a diet like you mentioned, may be able to lose 40 or 50 pounds, may even be able to sustain that diet. Diets like the South Beach diet, the Zone diet, and I have to say to a lesser degree, the Atkins diet have given people some success in weight loss and also some favorable movement in their cholesterol panel and their blood pressure, probably due to the weight loss. But on the other hand, it's a little more difficult for me to recommend someone beyond that kind of diet when I know that a more plant-based diet is optimal, acknowledging that not everybody and perhaps even very few people can adopt that kind of diet entirely.
Okay. Good enough for you, Doctor?
Yeah, I agree. I think there's still a lot to learn about diet and how it plays a role, and what the perfect diet is an excellent question. And if I had that answer,
yeah.
I think, you know, I don't know that I'd be sitting here with you, Evan, if I knew which diet was best for everybody. But I think that, you know, certainly more fruits and vegetables, I don't think anyone can argue with that. I think if you want to talk about fat content and what the perfect fat content is for your diet, that's certainly debatable, and I think if you talk to 10 different doctors, you'll get 10 different answers.
Al, thanks for the phone call. Dr. Bisignano, you've got a personal story on this? I mean, have you made some changes as well with your own diet?
Well, I think I try to adhere as much as I can to the Mediterranean-type diet, a DASH diet. I've tried a number of other things, including a plant-based diet, which I found very difficult to follow in the long term. In the short term, you can do any diet for a month. But I think a word for our that's very important to our listeners is if one wants to achieve weight loss, one has to pick a diet or an approach to food that you can stay on for 3, 6, 9, and 12 months. And when, you know, selecting a diet to achieve whatever goal it is, whether it's weight loss, blood pressure control, lipid control, something that you can sustain. And I would say the same thing about exercise. The right kind of exercise to do is something that you will do 3 to 6 times per week for a half an hour, that you can tolerate and that you can do over the course of months and years.
Now, when I hear the word diet, to me, a neon sign flashes temporary. I think lifestyle, that's a change.
I think that's an important distinction to make.
A question from Anna, a listener who just wants to know, can you define the difference between good and bad cholesterol?
Well, when we check a cholesterol panel on somebody, we have the HDL, which we call, generally speaking, a good cholesterol because it the higher the better. It's usually higher in people who exercise more or are of lower weight. And there's also some bit of a genetic predisposition to have either having either a higher or lower cholesterol. But we found that the LDL cholesterol or the bad cholesterol is probably the one that's most closely correlated with heart disease and stroke. And that's why so many of our therapies are targeted now at the LDL cholesterol, including the statin therapy that was mentioned earlier in the show.
Okay. Let me, since we've got a little bit of time left, let me squeeze in a question that I wanted to ask that amazed me. I've mentioned it earlier this hour, and I'll say it again. I mean, I really am amazed what the doctors here, what our medical community can do for our health. And my stepfather needed a valve replacement and about a year ago and had it done through a catheter, right? I mean, that's I think it was not open heart. It was, I think it was, so I think it was a catheter valve replacement surgery. I'd never heard of it. I was amazed that you could do that. Mm-hmm. What he was told at the time before they determined that he could get that was that he had to be deemed some kind of high risk at his age to get it done in this country, because otherwise I think I was told, and again, this is all just a game of telephone over multiple states and multiple people, so forgive me on this, but I was told that, you know, with insurance, if he were in Italy, if he were in parts of Europe, he could have it done, boom. Whereas here, we're still waiting to get that green lighted by insurance unless he was deemed high risk. He was deemed high risk. He had the catheter valve replacement done. He's doing very well. Again, amazing that you could do that. So where do we think... Please help correct any part of my story here.
That sounds about right.
That's about right?
Yep. I think, first of all, I completely agree. The technology's gotten pretty incredible. We're moving more and more to minimally invasive procedures where you have to do open heart surgery less and you're able to do a lot through a catheter. And exactly what you're talking about, I think, is becoming more common. This is where you would replace the aortic valve, not through open heart surgery, but essentially the valve deploys through a catheter right into your heart. And we are doing it at the University of Rochester. It used to be reserved for only high-risk patients here in the United States. There are now studies where we are moving towards patients who have what would be considered moderate risk, and in Europe, even low risk, with the hope of preventing open-heart surgery. I think the only thing I will say for that is that the catheter approach isn't for everybody, and sometimes a true open-heart surgery is the best way to go.
Why is that?
It depends. You know, I think if you're a healthy young person, the valves that you can get through open heart surgery are very good valves and tend to last longer. I think at this point in time, we don't have the length of studies that we need to say that if I place a catheter through or a valve through a catheter, it's going to last you 50 years. We just haven't had the technology around long enough to say that with certainty. You know, 50 years from now, we might be doing that very easily. Mm-hmm. But at this point, we just don't have the data at to really say that. So it depends on how confidently you feel about the technology, but it is doing a lot of good for a lot of people who couldn't get their valve replaced before.
Yeah, in general, I mean, I think of my catheter ablation. Before catheter ablation, that would have been open heart. I think of my stepfather's valve replacement, which, you know, again, wasn't open heart. So we're moving in a direction of less open heart. You know, though we'll probably never fully get rid of that for the reasons that you're describing,
right,
it sounds like.
Right. It's hard to say. I would never say never, but I think the more we can do through the catheter, the less invasive it is. You know, the easier you are to get out of the hospital. There's a lot of good benefit to that.
Yeah, really amazing. Last quick question then. Had an email about aneurysms. This is something that in my family it comes up once in a while. How do you make sure that if you are diagnosed with an aneurysm or someone in your family is diagnosed with an aneurysm, you understand how big it is and when it becomes something to worry about, what you might be able to do about it?
Well, an aneurysm is just a ballooning out of some part of an artery, and that could happen in almost any part of the arteries, whether it's near the heart, in the chest, in the belly, in the legs, in the neck. And there's different standards, different cutoffs for how big of an aneurysm is something that has to be watched or something that has a probability of getting bigger and rupturing. Many smokers need screening now for aneurysms in their belly, and most smokers over the age of 65 are eligible for this kind of screening and probably should get that.
In their belly, you said?
Yeah, in the aorta that passes through their belly on the way to their legs. And when somebody has an aneurysm, we really focus on the usual things, treatment of cholesterol and pushing the blood pressure very much toward the goal where it should be, definitely under 140 over 90 and in certain people closer to 120 over 80.
Okay. Well, we've learned so much this hour. Really, really great stuff. And I just want to thank our guests for being here, both Dr. Shalek and Dr. Bisignano. Answered a lot of listener questions and via Twitter, via email, via the phones. That's what we try to do on Second Opinion Live and, of course, here on Connections every afternoon. Thank you to both of you. I know our audience appreciates it, so thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
A pleasure being here.
And we want to also thank the Second Opinion sponsor, Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association. They always do such great work in making sure we can bring this to you. Thanks to all of you listening on WXXI AM 1370. It's the weekend. I don't say this often enough, but I'm going to say this now. Don't miss us on the weekend. Megan Mack and I work to put together a brand new podcast for you, which you may not know about. We just called Weekend Connections, and it's sort of a highlight reel of standout moments from the week. So if you can't listen to the 2 hours every day, you know, no one's perfect. And there, you know, we try to grab moments that you might want to listen to. And it's 20 minutes or less, perfect for a treadmill or a walk, you know. Heart doctors here, they like hearing that. So, or drive anywhere you're going. So Weekend Connections is our podcast, and you'll find it if you subscribe to Connections as a podcast. Our thanks to John Andrus, the engineer, the whole team at Second Opinion. Thanks for the great work they do. And, of course, Megan Mack, the heart and soul of this program. I'm Evan Dawson. Have a great weekend, and we'll talk to you Monday.